The following show was aired live on a Sunday evening on July 24, 2011. It was on Universal Healthcare and Medicare. I added, deleted, and refined it a bit, so I hope you enjoy it.
Hi, everyone. This is Atrevida, and welcome to Conversations on a Tightrope. We're going to discuss Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. I have it planned that I would like to first talk about the Canadian system and in a way play tribute to the father of Medicare, which was Tommy Douglas from Saskatchewan, Canada. He was born in 1904, October 20th, and he died February 24th, 1986. He did many things for the Canadians. He was a reverend of a Baptist church in Weyburn, Canada. And then he left the clergy to run for office to help get equal justice for the people of Saskatchewan. For 15 years, he fought the system. He was accused of being a socialist. Sound familiar? The big capitalist corporations, banks, oil, etc., pulled their money out of Saskatchewan to force public opinion against his universal health plan. The doctors went on strike, literally would not help their patients. But foreign doctors from many other countries, including the United States, came to Saskatchewan to treat the citizens. But the government wouldn't allow those doctors to treat them in the hospital, so small clinics had to open up because the government wouldn't allow it. So in these small clinics, that is eventually what helped universal health care in Canada to succeed. What a story. Before I continue with his other contributions, I want you to know that I have a guest co-host, and I'm very excited. He's a very nice young man, and his name is
Devin McConnell.
I'm so sorry. And I just met Devin. He just graduated, right, Devin? Okay. And you're from Ichabod Crane in Kinderhook. And you plan on?
Actually, I'm going to major in political science through Albany and Geneseo.
I'm so sorry. I didn't have the mic on. So I think I'm going to let you repeat that. Go ahead, hon.
Yeah, I'm Devin McConnell. I'm a recent graduate from Ichabod Crane High School over in Kinderhook, so not too far from here. And I'm actually going to be majoring in political science, going through Albany, then to Geneseo. So I'm a pretty big student of both the politics and the history and everything involved here, really.
I remember when I met you the other day, you were in Tell It Like It Is.
Mm-hmm.
And you were on Christine Malisoff's show talking about the rallies, right?
Yes. I was on partially representing MoveOn.org as at least one of their activists, explaining on the program that morning what the protest that afternoon were going to be about and encouraging people to get out to protest possible cuts through these budget negotiations to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and a lot of other entitlement programs.
Well, I think it's wonderful to be 18 years old and interested in politics, which is what you want to eventually major in, right?
Exactly.
And even having you here, it gives extra, force to the whole argument, because this is going to be your future. And
hopefully.
I feel that you should also have a say in it. So let me continue for a second. I do want to tell people that Tommy Douglas was a member of parliament in Canada from 1935 to 1940. He was the premier of Saskatchewan from 1944 to 1961 and a member of parliament from 1962 to 1979. He was the leader of CCF, which was Saskatchewan's Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, and a leader of the New Democratic Party. But his contributions are amazing. He provided full medical, dental, drug coverage to those needing state assistance. He established quality education for all, introduced free air ambulance service, which was essential to the North, and he was the first to provide universal coverage for hospitalization, the first to introduce a budget bureau to provide long-term planning, the first to introduce government insurance, the first government to allow collective bargaining for all workers, including civil servants. He created the first arts board in Canada, the first to introduce a Farm Security Act in North America, the first to grant the right to vote at age 18, and first to introduce the 8-hour work week, 5-day work week, and paid holidays for workers. The first small claims court in North America, the first Bill of Rights in Canada, and the first universal Medicare plan in North America. No wonder why Canadians
voted him.
Yes, and they voted him the best Canadian citizen.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to play. He's famous for two oratories. One is called Tommy Douglas's Story of Mouseland. It's really something you have to listen to. It's quite entertaining and tells you a lot about the politics of government. And then Tommy Douglas also tells the story of the cream separator, which is about the capitalist system. And first, let me play for you the Tommy Douglas. Let me get his, here it is, and I hope you enjoy it. I know what happened.
And every 4 years they held an election, used to walk down to the polls and cast their ballots. Some of them even got a ride to the polls. And they got a ride for the next 4 years afterwards, too. Just like you and me. And every time on election day, all the little mice used to go to the ballot box and they used to elect a government. A government made up of big, fat, black cats. Now, if you think it's strange that mice should elect a government made up of cats, you just look at the history of Canada. And maybe you'll see they weren't any stupider than we are. Now, I'm not saying anything against the cats. They were nice fellows. They conducted their government with dignity. They passed good laws. That is, laws that were good for cats. But the laws that are good for cats aren't very good for mice. One of the laws said that mouse holes have to be big enough so that a cat could get his paw in. Another law said that mice could only travel at certain speeds so that a cat could get his breakfast without too much effort. All of the laws were good laws for cats. But oh, they were hard on the mice. And life was getting harder and harder. And when the mice couldn't take it anymore, they decided something had to be done about it. So they went en masse to the polls and they voted the black cats out. They put in the white cats. And still, nothing changed. They voted the white cats out and they put the black ones in again. And you can imagine what happened then. And they even tried half black cats and half white cats and they called it a coalition. But that didn't change anything. You see, my friends, the trouble was not the color of the cats. The trouble was that they were cats. So naturally, they looked after cats instead of mice. And then one day, there came along one little mouse who had an idea. My friends, watch out for that little fellow with an idea. And he said to all the little mice, he said, "Listen, fellas, why do we keep on electing a government made up of cats? Why don't we elect a government made up of mice?" "Oh," they said, "he's a Bolshevik. Lock him up." And so they threw him in jail. But I want to remind you, you can lock up a mouse and you can lock up a man. But you can't lock up an idea. And one of these days, that little mouse is going to get himself elected. Myself, I say it's high time.
Okay, that was his very famous Mouseland speech. What did you think of it, Kevin? Sounds like our government, doesn't it?
It sounds like when FDR would go after the economic royalists. It sounds like when he would get up there and decry what was his class that he threw right down and betrayed to be there with the people.
Okay. So there is that.
And he was the one who started Social Security, from which we birthed Medicare and Medicaid.
What would we do without people who cared about people and not just the almighty dollar?
We'd have a government of cats.
Well, I think he was really quite a man. And there is an interview that he did in 1976. He was interviewed, and there were some comments on this next audio that I'm going to play for you. And the comments said that Tommy, these are from Canadians, Tommy is Canada's national hero. In the USA, 65% Americans file bankruptcy because they can't pay for the medical bills. In Canada, the percentage is 0%. And Canadians spend one-third less of their GDP than Americans on their more effective, humane national single-payer system. Obama has failed miserably and only benefited insurance companies that contributed $500,000 to his campaign. Hillary had the right plan, and that's why she didn't get the Dems nomination. That was Yelton Shong who made that comment on YouTube. And then another comment was, why can't we have leaders like this anymore? He said what he meant and meant what he said. Without being an automaton or a strident harpy, a deeply religious man, I don't think he pushed his religion on anyone, save that he tried to help the least amongst us. And that was FM Hammy from YouTube. And another one is, the man ran balanced budgets every year in Saskatchewan. That was E. Montague. And then there was, Douglas knew what he was talking about when it came to health services in Canada. As Premier of Saskatchewan, he introduced the first universal medical insurance plan in North America, Stephen HP 62. Now I'm going to play the short clip that these people made the comment on. If I'm right here, yes, this is it.
I would propose that in the Act we say that the federal government will enter into a 50-50 arrangement with the provinces to institute nursing care, home nursing care, meals on wheels, that we would share 50% of the cost of setting up community health clinics, that we'd start a program of denticare among the school children.
But in other words, we should dictate the services that we're going to pay for.
No, we dictate the ones we're going to pay for. We would say these are the programs we're prepared to share with you on a 50-50 basis. Now, there's no way by which the federal government can dictate to the provinces that they must undertake those programs. But they can say to the provinces, if you want to institute these programs, we'll pay 50% of the cost. I think what most people miss is the essential point, namely that the provinces are even more interested than the federal government is in cutting costs down, because the provincial governments are much less able to finance their half of the cost than the federal government is. So if the federal government's worried about escalating costs, just imagine what little provinces like New Brunswick and Newfoundland and Nova Scotia feel about rising health costs.
And we get caught in the middle?
You mean the public?
Yes.
Of course the public get caught in the middle, and the public who are going to get caught most severely are the ones in the poorer provinces. With the federal government copping out of some of its responsibility for Medicare, the chances are that the more affluent provinces like Ontario and Alberta and British Columbia will be able to absorb the extra cost. But in the Atlantic provinces particularly, and in the prairie provinces if there were a few bad crops, the only way that they could get by would be to begin reducing medical care services. And if you do that, what you're really saying is there are two classes of Canadians. That those Canadians who live in well-to-do provinces are going to have a high standard of health services, and the people who live in the poorer provinces are going to have a very poor standard of health services. And that means that in the years ahead, there are going to be children who are going to be less healthy, children with poor teeth, children with long staying illnesses, whose health will be impaired because they happen to have grown up in a poor province. And that surely ought not to be the kind of standard we set for Canada.
Okay, so that was his discussion in 1976. I want to just mention another comment that I found, and this is what this Canadian, I'm not even sure if he was Canadian. He said, I had the good fortune of working in the Saskatchewan Legislative Building in the mid-70s. In several offices, I commented to the staff how nice their desk was. All said, it belonged to Tommy Douglas. Finally, I asked one guy, how can everyone say they have Tommy's old desk? He replied, it's like Christ and the cross. Everyone claims to have a piece of it. So, what do you think of Tommy Douglas so far?
He sounds like that savior of the country. He sounds like that person who led a revolution for Canada. I don't know the whole history of Canada or its politics myself. But to me, he bears a striking resemblance, if you were to parallel America, he bears a striking resemblance, like I said earlier, to FDR. He sounds like that leader who led a second revolution, not one that overthrows a country or anything like that, but one that changes the country. He sounds like that one that took the people's power and brought it to the capital and made the changes for them, which only so rarely happens, I say, in history.
Because in the 30s, when he started out, there were no regulations on corporations. People got hurt in factories and got bad food. Nothing was checked because the people weren't important. And sometimes I think there are those who want to go back to that. They just...
You're talking about FDR in our country, right?
Well, no, I'm talking
about Canada.
In both.
That sounds very familiar.
Yes,
I can't tell.
But that's just it.
That's the thing.
In the 30s, that's what was going on.
Right.
And that's what they were fighting. And what a legacy he left. Of course, we didn't know him, but it's what I would like to see more young people aspire to.
Right.
And I hope we get lots of them. So now I'm going to play you his other great story. And this is the story of the cream separator. It's one of his favorites, and it's an analysis of the capitalist economic system. The story was suggested by Tommy Douglas's reading of Lewis Mumford, who had argued during the age of expansion, capitalism gave cream to the few, whole milk to the middle classes, and a blue watery residue to the majority of farmers and industrial workers, agricultural laborers, and slaves. The way in which Douglas adapted this rather arid analysis to his rural audiences testifies to his oratorical genius. So let me play the cream separator, and here we go.
Here's a typical Douglas anecdote that not only entertains, but also makes a point. It's called the cream separator, and Tommy Douglas uses it to show the inequitable distribution of income, of how easily people can become the victims of a worn-out economic system.
I used to visit and farm homes, particularly around mealtime. And if I get in around dinner time, of course, everybody in the family was busy. They were unhitching the horses. They were pumping water. They were milking the cows. They were pitching down the hay and the oat sheaves. Somebody else was out gathering the eggs. Somebody else was feeding the pigs and the chickens. Everybody has something to eat, even the youngsters were given the job doing something, such as gathering eggs or feeding the chickens. And here I was, right off the city streets, you know, I didn't know what to do. I said, well, give me something to do. Well, nobody was going to trust the city boy with milking a good cow. They gave me the one job, you know, that anybody could do. They gave me the job of turning the handle on the old cream separator. Any of you ever turned the handle on a cream separator? Well, you know, quite the experience. I got to be pretty good at it. I got to the place where I could tell you how many verses of Onward Christian Soldiers it takes to put a pan of milk through this thing. And as I was turning the handle, and they were pouring in the milk, and I could see the cream coming out of one spout and the skim milk coming out of the other spout, one day it finally penetrated my thick Scotch head that this cream separator is exactly like our economic system. Here are the primary producers, the farmers and the fishermen and the loggers. They're pouring in the milk. And here are the workers. Whether they work on the railroad or go down to the mines or sail ships or work in a store or a bank or teach school, clerk in the store, work in a hospital, they're the people whose services make the economy go round, and they're turning the handle. So here you got it. Primary producer puts in the milk. People who work with hand and brain turn the handle. And then I thought, but there's another fellow here somewhere. There's a fellow who owns this cream separator. And he's sitting on a stool with a cream spout in his mouth. And the primary producer and the worker, they take turns on the skim milk spot. And they don't like skim milk. Nobody likes skim milk. And they blame it on each other. And the worker says, if those farmers and fishermen, you know, would work a little harder, well, I wouldn't be drinking this skim milk. fishermen and the farmers say if those workers didn't demand a 40-hour week, didn't want such high wages, I wouldn't have to live on this blue milk. But you know they're both wrong. The farmers and the fishermen have produced so much that we don't know what to do with it. We've got surpluses of foodstuffs. And the workers, they've produced so well that today nearly 500,000 of them are unemployed. The fault isn't with the worker, it isn't with the primary producer. The fault is with this machine. This machine was built to give skim milk to the worker and the primary producer, and to give cream to the corporate elite. And as a matter of fact, it doesn't always do that. Because every once in a while, this little fellow sitting on the stool with the cream spout in his mouth gets indigestion. And he says, "Boys, stop the machine. We've got a recession." He says to the worker, "You're laid off. You can go on unemployment insurance. And after that, on welfare." And he says to the farmers and the fishermen, "You know, we don't need your stuff. Take it back home." Then he sits for a while. Indigestion gets better. He burps a couple of times. He says, "All right, boys, start the machine. Happy days are here again. Cream for me and skim milk for both of you." Now, what the Democratic Socialist Party have been saying to Canadians for a long time is that the time has come in this land of ours for the worker and the primary producer to get their hands on the regulator of the machine, so that it begins to produce homogenized milk in which everybody will get a little cream.
After that great speech, I'd like to take a short break and play a song I found on YouTube. It was uploaded by Paul Hipp, H-I-P-P, on September 9th, 2009, and it's called We're Number 37. Here we go.
Sure to bring your gun and buddy, we're number 37. We're the USA. We're number 37. And we're so proud to say, we got old people crying at the pharmacy, paying deductible. This ain't the land of the free grandma. We're number 37. And we're the USA. People of the town, and that is the Christian way. And brother, we're number 37. We in the USA, the big number 37. And we're so proud to say, we're number one in tanks, we're number one in planes, we're number one in war, we're number two for brains. And buddy, we're number 37. We in the USA. I chew a Hitler mustache on the president. Yeah.
We're number 37.
You know, I don't know what's wrong with wanting everyone to get a little bit of the pie.
It's called greed?
That's right. It really is greed. When the bottom line is, there's one group, and we can call them a name for a party or not, but there's one group that the bottom line is, whenever they make an argument, it's always about the almighty dollar. And the other group is trying to find a way for people to just get a fair share. And what really annoys me, Devin, is that people will use the argument, well, there are people who are, there's fraud in Medicare, and people take advantage, and I know this one who's doing this, and I know that. Well, you know something? That trickles down from the top. That's what those on top do. They do the exact same thing, and there will always be corruption in the top and on the bottom. But why does everybody want to jump on the little guy when they should be jumping on the big guy so that they can change that whole behavior?
Upton Sinclair once famously said of Americans, when he was pioneering in the early 20th century, he said that the reason socialist ideas and socialist programs haven't caught on in America is because no one in America considers themselves exploited proletariat. They consider themselves temporarily embarrassed millionaires. That may just hold some of the key to why America is just a little different than the rest of these countries that have done these other things that we wish we could do. In America, we were, I think, at least through history, if you look at it, given this idea, this promise, what we frame as the American dream, that if you go out and do it, everything is yours all on your own. If you go out and work and do your fair share, you get your fair share. It's just built that way. Well, like Tommy was saying with the machine, it's not built that way.
No, it isn't.
But we're sold this idea, this dream. And as George Carlin said, if it's a dream, you have to be asleep to believe it. Because that's generally what you get from someone who says what you were saying, the other side of the argument. That, well, you know, there's these welfare queens out there, you know, sucking off the system. There's this and that and the fraud. And I've heard that, too. I've heard that quite often. I think of it as self-justification for greed. I think of it as trying to find a way to poke a hole through this broader narrative of doing what's right for everybody. Well, not everyone's right.
Right.
Not everyone's worthy. Not everyone should have it. And to that, it's simply, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are some people that you can always exploit for a story, for your own narrative. You can take a little story, you can take a little hyperbole, mix it together, and you can start poking holes in everyone else's arguments, popping every balloon. And frankly, this person sucking out of the cream will appreciate that.
That's right.
But eventually, at least my hope is eventually everyone will see through that.
Well, we have to try. We have to try. That has to be our goal. This has been throughout the ages. People have been fighting for justice for all people. And the thing is, part of the insidious plan on the top is that they make these cuts saying, well, we have to have less spending, you know, we have to cut education, we have to cut health. First of all, I think there should be a marriage of different systems. I mean, if you're going to have capitalism, you can't have unregulated capitalism. And secondly, these arguments aren't going to really work, because you can't have a democracy if you cut education or you cut health. And education and health shouldn't be part of a profit-making business. You can only have a democracy with educated people and healthy people, right?
Right. But who said that the economic elites want a democracy?
Well, that's what they try to say they want, and people want to believe it. They've also gotten, when I grew up, I got into this, well, you can't beat City Hall.
Right.
So I really think a lot of people really felt, you know, you really can't. So maybe if I kind of like, you know, just get to know the right people, it's easier that way anyway. And then they don't even have to work that hard. So I'm going to play another clip. And this one is on Tommy Douglas's CCF 50th anniversary speech on healthcare. So let me see this one.
When you go back to your constituency and you run into somebody who says, it's all a good idea for you soft-hearted humanitarians, but we can't afford it, let me give you a simple statistic which you can put down on a piece of paper and carry in your head. And that is that our friends in the United States are spending 9% of their gross national product. And they get a higher per capita gross national product than we do. They spend 9% of their gross national product on health care, and 34 million of their people have no health care coverage. And in Canada, we spend 7% of our gross national product, and every man, woman, and child in Canada is covered under Medicare. If you want a two-tiered health program, then just continue the way we're going. And I remind you that in this movement, we pledged ourselves 50 years ago that we would provide health care for every man, woman, and child, irrespective of their color, their race, or their financial status. And by God, we're going to do it!
Okay, so that was the last speech of Tommy that I'm going to play. But there's something I make a bet many of you don't know. If you know the actor Kiefer Sutherland, Kiefer Sutherland is Tommy Douglas's grandchild. And I found that out when I was doing my research. And he made a plea for, for the Medicare pledge in Canada. And I just want you to listen to it.
Hi, my name is Kiefer Sutherland. My grandfather, Tommy Douglas, believed passionately that access to health care is the right of every citizen. And he warned us to be vigilant in order to preserve the legacy of public health care that he left us. Tommy was at the founding meeting of the CHC and said afterwards that our best hope lies in the Canadian Health Coalition for the preservation and extension of Medicare in Canada. Tommy's words describe best what the Canadian Health Coalition's current campaign is about. We're going to make the governments in this country sit up and listen. And we're going to tell them that our parents and our grandparents worked and fought and suffered to get us Medicare, and we're not going to let anybody take it away. My mother, Shirley Douglas, is a friend of the Canadian Health Coalition. She knows that if we believe in Medicare, we have to stand up and defend it. I am also a passionate defender of my grandfather's health care legacy and vision for Canada. That's why I signed the Canadian Health Coalition's Medicare pledge. If you care about health care, I urge you to do the same. Please, sign today. Thank you.
So that was Kiefer Sutherland, and gives another speech about his grandfather, but I'm not going to use that one right now.
The following YouTube video was uploaded by Master Coder 1 on 6/24/2008. It is one person's fictionalized view of what the future of healthcare in the U.S. could sound like. I will read the embedded statements in the video. It begins with Frank Vidal, MMC.
What is the problem with healthcare? Everybody seems to have a different opinion about it, and a very vociferous yet hidden one. Every opinion wants to be heard, but the face behind the opinion, you don't get to see that. What's the problem with healthcare? Money. Lots of it. I'm not afraid to talk about it. I'm also not afraid to let you see me, because we do have to do something about it.
The way I see it, if we don't do something about it, we just might be hearing something like this in 25 to 30 years. You never know.
The events that you are about to perceive are fictional and take place in the future. Everyone has a different vision of the future. We have no idea how the future will look. However, we can safely assume most things will still sound like they do today. This story will be told using only sounds, so close your eyes and listen. You might actually hear it coming. One day in the not-too-distant future.
Honey, I've got my period really weird this month. I'm going to the doctor. Okay. See you.
Hello, welcome to your personal physician. Your personal doorway to customized automatic healthcare. Please insert your ID card in the slot.
Thank you. Please insert your finger into the slot. We will perform a customized, personalized, almost human spontaneous total blood test. This way we can tell you how you are feeling. You do not have to tell us. How is that for service?
Hello. I am Dr. Voice of Frank's computer. Your custom blood analysis is complete. You have a
brain tumor,
and you will die in approximately
16 days.
This schedule would make your date of death fall on
Tuesday, October 23rd.
Your policy does not permit dying on Tuesdays or in the months of October, July, or April. Please select another date on which you prefer to die. The next available date covered by your plan is
November 11, 2031.
If this date is convenient, please press 1, otherwise press 2, and someone from our Date of Death Reassignment Department will contact you regarding your end of life options. You are not allowed to die on a non-covered day, or your deductible will be applied to your children and grandchildren with an interest rate of 37% compounded daily. This offer is not valid in Alaska or Delaware, where you are simply not allowed to die or to get sick. Thank you for visiting your neighborhood doctor's office. Have a happy and healthy day. Your $200 copayment has automatically been deducted from your checking account.
One of two things just happened. If you were laughing, you just stopped. If you were thinking, then it just hit you. It really could happen one day. What you may not realize is that unless the healthcare equation is balanced, this will probably take place on any given day.
Okay. I'd like to go into our introduction to Medicare and the two U.S. government programs that guarantee health insurance for the elderly and the poor, respectively. They were formally enacted in 1965 as amendments, titles 18 and 19, respectively, to the Social Security Act in 1935 and went into effect in 1966. The Medicare program covers most persons age 65 or older and consists of four related health insurance plans. That's the Medical Insurance Plan Part B, the Medical Care Advantage Plans Part C, and, of course, Part D, the prescription drug coverage. Then we have Medicaid, and Medicaid is a health insurance program established for low-income persons under age 65 and persons over that age who have exhausted their Medicare benefits. So the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is the PPACA enacted in 2010, significantly affected both Medicare and Medicaid. For example, it was designed to gradually shrink Medicare's drug coverage donut hole until it is completely eliminated, a goal set for 2020. The federal subsidies to Part C were designated to be cut, and Medicare payroll taxes for high income earners were set to increase starting in 2013. Among the other provisions of the PPACA, Medicaid reimbursements were scheduled to be increased to match those of Medicare by 2013. About half of the 32 million people added to health insurance rolls as a result of the PPACA were to be added to Medicaid since eligibility was expanded to cover by 2014. The federal government planned to pay all costs for newly eligible recipients for an initial period, but Washington's portion was designed to decline gradually thereafter. There is Senator Harkin just recently on July 20th uploaded a video on YouTube about the recent House Republicans' plan known as Cut, Cap, and Balance, in which he called to say that it should be the Cut, Cap, and Kill Medicare Act. So let me play this for you.
With good reason, critics are calling this the Cut, Cap, and Kill Medicare bill. This is not simply rhetoric, it's reality. In fact, the cut isn't just a nick. The cut is more like an amputation, cutting the legs out from underneath the federal government. And the cap, is it just a small cap? I prefer to call it a decapitation, taking the head off of the federal government's resources and the power to respond to the needs of our country. This legislation is so extreme, it will require the dismantling of Medicare as we know it, along with significant cuts to Social Security, Medicaid, and other programs that undergird the middle class in our country. The sad reality is that America no longer has a two-party system. One of our two parties has morphed into a kind of a cult, driven by a singular fixation and obsession, preserving and expanding tax breaks for the wealthy at all costs. This so-called balanced budget amendment would make it all but impossible to raise revenues in the future. This would permanently lock in the benefits of special tax breaks for the wealthy, as well as the outrageous 15% tax rate for hedge fund billionaires. So millionaires and billionaires get royal treatment. It's the middle class that would be devastated by the cut, cap, and kill Medicare bill. Let me just focus briefly on Medicare. Where did the Republicans come up with this idea of capping federal spending at 18% of GDP? Why is it 18%? Do you ever ask, why wasn't it 18.5 or 19.2? Where did they come up with 18? This is not an arbitrary number. It's a number with a purpose. The last time federal spending was at 18% of GDP was in 1966, before Medicare took hold. Got it? They want to roll it back to kill Medicare. The most elementary budget arithmetic dictates that you cannot limit the federal budget to 18% of GDP and continue to sustain Medicare, not unless you're willing to cut the rest of the federal budget by 50%. So this new assault on Medicare comes hard on the heels of the so-called Ryan budget, the Republican budget. And what was the centerpiece of that? It was to dismantle Medicare, replace it with a private voucher program, with seniors paying two-thirds of the cost of their private health care coverage. So Republicans have now opened a two-front assault on Medicare. The Republican budget takes a direct, open approach. It just dismantles Medicare. And now this so-called cut, cap, and kill program takes an indirect approach to dismantling Medicare. In future years, it would simply defund Medicare. It would put the federal government in a fiscal straitjacket, allowed to spend no more than in the mid-1960s, before Medicare, and at a time when the elderly population was half of what it will be in the years ahead. So there you have it, a so-called balanced budget amendment permanently locks in tax breaks for the wealthy and special interests, takes a meat axe to Medicare, Social Security, and the whole range of programs that undergird the middle class. Frankly, this kind of uncompromising ideological extremism should have no place in our democracy.
So that was very recent. On July 20th, he uploaded that to YouTube. And the other thing, someone I was talking to was very annoyed about the fact that we constantly use this new term entitlement, that Social Security is an entitlement when it was really something that was set up. I mean, I know I paid lots of money, came out of my pocket when it was Social. So I used to say, what's that big tax up there? And it's for Social Security. And now I'm being told that it's an entitlement for it. So there's always a play on words and to help make something sound like it's not worthy of support. I have an idea, Devin, and then I'm going to ask you what you think of it, because at 10-2, I usually go into something else. But my idea is for Social Security to get revenues. I suggest that why can't our American corporations be required to add a small Social Security surcharge on all employees who are not Americans in other countries? These are the American corporations that go to other countries. They pick up their buildings here and they transport it to another country. Why can't they pay if they don't either ask the employees of that country to pay a surcharge, or the government require the corporations to pay a small surcharge for each of those employees in another country because of the fact that they're taking a job away from someone in the United States? And then they could put that surcharge of all of those thousands or millions of employees into the Social Security fund until we can find a way to get our own people to work.
That would be a very good plan to stop outsourcing. The only reason that outsourcing is lucrative in the first place is because of all the tax loopholes written into the system that make it cheaper. Doing something like that to reverse the trend would actually certainly combat outsourcing. But I actually think two things of what to do about Social Security. That's not a bad idea, I think, if other countries had Social Security. I was in a class when I was in high school just a few months ago, and we were looking at overpopulation in some countries like India and China. Mm-hmm. And people in those countries overproduce because they need their children to carry them through the red bull years. They need to be able to rely on their children. They need to be those spinster aunts and things like that. I thought to myself while I was watching this, I thought, you know, if they had a system like ours, if they had Social Security in India, these people wouldn't have, they would have some security in their old age like we do in America. They wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't have some of those other problems because their societies would be built a little more structurally. They wouldn't have to overpopulate. They wouldn't have so many people. They wouldn't produce so much poverty if they actually could support themselves by setting up a system like that. I think that would actually be a brilliant idea for other countries to emulate, to have a social security system. And that in place would still make it more expensive for our businesses to go over there. It starts to level the playing field between, you know, American workers and Indian workers or Chinese workers or whichever third world country you're going to. That would be a great idea if other countries could put it towards their citizens, because a global social security system would be an amazing thing. It would be an achievement for all mankind. In America, the easier thing to do about social security, and this is surprising because neither of these solutions are easy, but the easier thing to do about social security would simply be to lift the cap on how much of the income the tax is paid on. Mm-hmm. Social security as it's set up currently still is pretty much a regressive tax. You have progressive taxes, whereas you make more money, you pay a higher rate. The rate slides up with the amount of income. Social Security is essentially regressive. Only people that make a certain amount and lower pay the tax, at least on that income. If you make up to, I believe it's $105 or $110, somewhere up there, $1,000 a year. It's about $110, I think. $110,000 a year. All that income, $110,000 and below, has a Social Security tax applied to it. All income above that, completely excluded. If you took that cap off and said all income is subject to Social Security tax, the problem's gone. I mean, right now, the way it was set up back in the 80s with Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan and all that, the trust fund's built up and has subsequently been raided, but it does exist as IOUs. The trust fund's been built up to last through 20, 30, 7, 6, whatever it turns out to be when you get closer. It'll change a little bit, but till 2030-something. Lifting that cap would make it funded through the rest of the century. It would fix Social Security altogether. It was a pretty well-set-up system. It just has a little intentional problem built in to make it a little harder to fund. And if you just took that out, the problem would be gone.
Okay, folks. You see, I know we have an education problem in this country, but not right here sitting next to me. I have to tell you, I'm going to bring him home, and maybe he can help me out with my finances. But that's wonderful, Devin. Really, really wonderful that you've learned so much and you have a really good head. I hope you will think about what Devin said. He had some really great points. And think about what's really happening if you don't like these cuts in Medicare and Social Security and you feel that there should be more taxes on the rich. Then you really have to get out there and make a statement. This really is not good for us. We shouldn't be putting this responsibility on the backs of the poor or the hardworking, not just the poor. And I have this thing, Devin. I wish people would email me. My email is atrevida, A-T-R-E-V-I-D-A, 45, at Verizon.net. Or you could do info@wgxc.org or feedback. Now, I want to ask you something. Do you like animals?
Yes.
Well, I have, let's see, I'm ready for my 10 minutes of animal connection. So what I'm going to do is, though, before I start it, I usually have, let's see, I think I can play this one. Okay, that was Menino the parrot. and I just couldn't resist it. And Menino, of course, was talking about how happy it is to know that I have an Animal Connection show. The first thing I want to say is I just want to express how sorry I am that Snuggles, my neighbor's six-year-old Yorkshire Terrier, has passed away. And I really can't express how excited and loving Snuggles was when he was alive. I always looked forward to meeting him on my way to get my mail in the mornings. And he would wag his tail uncontrollably when he spotted me and then let me shower him with hugs. And he will be missed. I know that his master was really very, you know, I could see how sad he was when he told me, because he was only 6 years old, he really went too soon. But I would like to play this song for Snuggles. It was written when Nellie McKay's dog had died, and it's called The Dog Song.
I'm just walking my dog, singing my song, strolling along. Yeah, it's just me and my dog, catching some sun. We can't go wrong. My life is lonely and blue. Yeah, I was sad as a sailor. I was an angry one too. Then there was you appeared when I was entangled with youth and fear and nerves jangled, jangled. Vermouth and beer were getting me mangled up. But then I looked in your eyes and I was no more a failure. You looked so wacky and wise. And I said, Lord, I'm happy 'cause I'm just a walking my dog. Tragic and sad. I was the archetypal loser. I was a pageant gone bad. Then there was you on time and wagging your tail in the cutest mime. But you was in jail. I said, Wolf, be mine. And you gave a wail. And then I was no longer alone. And I was no more a boozer. Lord, I'm happy 'cause I'm just a walking my dog, singing my song, strolling along. Yeah, it's just me and my dog, catching some sun. We can't go wrong, 'cause I don't care what the hate and your doubt, and I don't care what the politician's about. If you need a companion, why just go out to the pound and find yourself a hound and make that doggy proud, 'cause that's what it's all about.
Good dog. Thank you so much. I just want to thank everyone who fights for peace and justice around the world. And I want to thank my dog Joey, who's up in heaven. It's probably a good thing he always hated my music. But and then I would also like to just thank my mother, who tolerates my music, and she really should be here, you know, accepting this, because she's the most compassionate person I know. So this for you, Mom.
Wasn't that cool? I mean, really, that was the 2005 Genesis Awards. That's where she played that. Now, the second thing I'd like to do, which I don't usually do, but this is a book recommendation, Ed Breslin's Drinking with Miss Dutchie. Drinking with Miss Dutchie is a story about Dutchie, a black Labrador, and her lasting impact on the life of her owner and narrator, Ed Breslin. In contrast to the typical tale of a dog as man's best friend, Breslin's is a unique reflection on dog as role model and teacher. While the author struggles with clinical depression and addiction, Dutchie maintains her pure lust for life. Over 12 years, she masterfully and instinctively shows Breslin how to view the world for what it is and embrace it with full force. Raised in North Philadelphia, the second oldest of 12 children in an Irish Catholic family, Breslin recounts his lifelong struggles with alcoholism and depression and his exquisitely loving 30-year marriage to his wife, Lynn. Breslin tells us how Dutchie, through her elegant negotiation of the world's difficulties and upheavals, showed him how to quell his fears, unwittingly modeled how to strengthen his relationships, and encouraged him to live in the present. Ed Breslin is a former editor and publisher who spent two decades in the book business. He now writes and edits full-time. Ed lives with his wife in New York City and in the Hudson River Valley. So I thought that was a wonderful story. That's a book I think people should pick up and read. If you have a life is bearable when statement, you can email me that. Life is bearable when people don't endanger the lives of their dogs by letting their dogs run loose in public. And then I have a fortune cookie wisdom, which is any activity becomes creative when the doer cares about doing it right or better. So
I would like to end the show with an announcement for an event that will be taking place in Washington, D.C. On March 24th, Saturday, 2012, from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m., there will be a Reason Rally. This will be a movement-wide event sponsored by the country's major secular organizations. The intent will be to unify, energize, and embolden secular people nationwide while dispelling the negative opinions held by so much of American society. And they'll have a darn good time doing it. It will be the largest secular event in world history. There will be music, comedy, great speakers, and lots of fun. And it will be free. For more information, please visit reasonrally.org. That's reasonrally.org. And this is for March 24th, Saturday, 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. I'll be there, so maybe I'll see you. Goodbye.